Good morning and welcome to our roundtable panel for this Thursday, the 7th of August. I'm Joe Donahue. Welcome to our panel discussion this morning. Let me introduce our panelists to you. A reminder, of course, that you can always join in our conversation, roundtable at wamc.org. You can do it that way. You can go to our webpage. You can go to our Facebook page and comment there, or you can tweet us at WAMC Roundtable. These are all ways to communicate with us. But we're always checking our email during the program, and that way that we can know down to the minute if we suck or not, which is nice. So,
did you just say what I
I'm sorry.
Said?
Real time evaluation.
It's one of the pluses of looking at your email during the show. Oh, good. I don't have to wait till after the program. I can know right now that we're doing a lousy job.
And that's not one of the seven words.
No. I think we're okay. I heard it on another NPR program, so I'm just taking that license. Well, Libby Post is here. She is our political activist in-house, and we love having her here. And Libby, thank you very much for joining us. Daily Gazette editor, she's not here. Associate editor of the Times Union, Mike Spain, is with us. Hello.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm good.
And Daily Freeman publisher emeritus, Ira Fussfeld, joins us. Good morning, Ira.
Good morning. Nice to be back. It's been a while.
Yes, it is good to it's good to have you here. Always good to have you here, and it's wonderful to have the three of you. Should mention that Alan is away, is on vacation, so we are just wanted to mention that, but we thank you very much for joining us this morning. Let us get to the stories of the day. I feel like when you do that, the British always do it the best. They'll either say so-and-so is away or so-and-so is on holiday. Yes.
Remember Chicken Run?
Yeah.
She's going on holiday. I love that movie.
It is a winner.
Well, it's one of the best movies that that Mel Gibson ever did.
We can hate him for so much, but we can thank him for
Chicken Run. Was great. Yeah,
there you go. Okay, so let's go to stories on our minds and things going on. And I guess, you know, the one story I did not mention, I did not have in here, but I think we should mention because we've been talking about it a lot and we have been airing it all morning on our newscasts, and Libby mentioned this to us yesterday, and that is about Zephyr Teachout.
Right.
And so now we have this, there has been this long-going question as to the ballot situation and what the residency on the ballot and how that was all going to play out. She has said from the very beginning, we should note, she has said that she felt it was going to be a concerted effort to keep her off of the ballot. And what we are reading right now is that the Cuomo camp is contesting the residency of Zephyr Teachout before the primary, saying that she has spent more time in the state of Vermont than she has in the state of New York. And she has not lived in New York long enough to be eligible. But Ms. Teachout says that the challenge to her residency, which will be heard today in state Supreme Court in Brooklyn, is just an attempt to intimidate her as well as to sap her campaign of time and resources. How would you like to comment, Libby Post?
All of these ballot challenges are just a way of making the other campaign, the one that you're challenging, spend money, get them off their game, keep them from their message. We see it in Albany County. And we see it here. And the fact of the matter is that the State Board of Elections ruled that that the challenge had no merit, and that's why now it's going to court. And you know, given everything that's going on with the governor, one would think he would have more important things on his mind. Now, this is really, if Alan was here, he'd probably say this. This is really about the governor wanting to go into the November election in the strongest position possible, because if there is a primary, he's not going to get 70% of the vote because people are angry about the Moreland Commission and all of his friends, the people that he would think would be friends, they're all saying, I'm really busy right now. I have something else to do. So it's an interesting situation. So they're going to do this. This is going to be flashed over the headlines in every paper, the Post, the Times, the Daily News, the Times Union, everywhere, all until this whole thing is resolved. And again, it's not going to look good for the governor.
So let me ask this question, then we'll open it up for discussion. And that is, one of the things that we have talked about many times in this program is the option that the governor had of just letting her name appear on the ballot and not go to all of the trouble, because there was going to be, look, he had a ton of money. She mm-hmm. didn't have right. anything. And the name recognition, the polls would indicate that she doesn't have the following. So given this intention, and also her strategy from the very beginning of saying, well, look, they're going to do whatever they can to intimidate me and keep me off the ballot. And she's now continuing. And quite frankly, they're playing into her hands on that. My question being, does that mean that, do you think that the Cuomo camp would have done this regardless? Or do you think that they're doing it in this particular case now because perhaps they're a little concerned?
I don't think I doubt very much that Zephyr Teachout, even with the Moreland Commission issue behind them, posed a real threat to the governor winning a primary. So I can only presume that, as Libby points out, the ultimate goal here is to get her off the ballot so that he does not have the drag of a tight primary on his resume going forward. That said, it just smacks of the kind of politics that turn people off to politics. If he is able to succeed in getting her off the ballot on what appears to be a technicality, mm-hmm. Fine, those are the rules. But it only reinforces the increasing image of him as a bully and as somebody who is going to just steamroll his way, to borrow the Elliot Spitzer term. And it does not. It does not paint him in a good light. And you know, the I always sort of default to how smart these professional politicians are. And so they must have thought this through and said, yeah, we know that that's going to be the reaction, but we need to do this because of this. But boy, I just think it stinks. Yeah, to use the technical term.
Yes. That's the technical term. Well, don't you think that this could backfire now on Cuomo, in the sense that if she is able to remain on the ballot, and it looks like she has a pretty good chance at remaining on the ballot, it will become a rally cause for all the people who are angry at Cuomo for whatever, yes. whether it's Moreland Act or whether it's the SAFE Act or whether it's,
But at the end of the day, people are going to go into the, let's say it's a three-way, a general election three-way ballot, and people are going to go in. And they're gonna, there are people who might not be crazy about Cuomo who would just not vote for Astorino because of Astorino's positions. Mm-hmm. And similarly, there are people who would not vote for Zephyr Teachout, who they may view as too far to the other side. So Cuomo has positioned himself in the middle and will gather most of that. So I don't think that he's in trouble of winning the re-election.
I didn't want to suggest that there's a reasonable chance, at least at this point, that Teachout could defeat him in a primary. Yeah. But what would the percentage have to be for him to be considerably embarrassed and it to sort of take the momentum out of this?
60-40.
If it was 60-40, so if she were able to
get... You think 60-40 would be embarrassment?
Yes.
Yeah, I was going to say less than 10 points. 60-40 is still generally a landslide.
That's I
get that.
Strong, yeah.
Right, but for a governor... Yeah. But for this governor?
Yeah, for this governor and a minor party calendar.
Right,
yeah.
Right. And this isn't... It's not going to be a three-way. She's not... On the Working Families Party, remember, got that.
I got you. Right.
Right, and you're not hearing anything from them lately. And so it'll be a two-way once this is all over, and it'll be Astorino versus... But think of this in terms of...
Well, you have the Green Party.
Oh, I'm sorry, Howie. That's right. You do have the Green Party.
On the ballot.
Okay,
the
fine.
Ballot.
But, think about what this will mean when we go into January. If the Democrats control both houses of the legislature, and he is sort of damaged goods.
Well, there's this, and I know that this is a snapshot and it's anecdotal, but I was taken by one of those typical man on the street things they did on Channel 4 in New York the other night. And they interviewed four or five people, which is hardly a scientific survey. But there were, I believe, of the four or five, two people who had no idea what the Moreland Commission issue was. And
yes,
and the fact is, generally speaking, on many issues that the four of us and the political and journalism class in the Albany area feel are everybody must be talking about. The fact is, very few people are talking about it. What? So that the Moreland thing is probably not going to have great legs going forward, unless there is this kind of smoking gun that
has
really
yet to emerge.
That has yet
right.
to emerge.
Right. Right. Yeah. Well, but if Teach Out is able to be on the ballot, it will be only those most motivated, those angry about Moreland
yeah.
Act or other things that will come out. And that will cause, you know, something less of a landslide for Cuomo, which won't look good. It's not going to cost him mm-hmm. the nomination. It's
no.
not going to cost him the election, I don't think, at least at this point, unless there's some incredible smoking gun that comes out between now and then. But it sort of interferes with this momentum that he has done everything right, you know, like his ads portray it, you know, brought in all the budgets.
Well, and
on
about
time and,
about the ads, we can assume that he wouldn't be spending the money that he's spending or would have to spend the money if she's not on the ballot. So not that he has to really worry about the cash, but this is money that he's spending on the money that he's spending in the primary that he wouldn't have to spend if she weren't on the ballot.
But he was already going heavy on ads even before Teach Out was involved.
Yeah,
he targeted Astorino.
Yeah, these ads aren't about Teach Out. They're about Astorino.
Yeah.
More, that's true. You know, because it's
and
the
if
Christmas
he doesn't spend
July.
Money on ads, I mean, what's he going to do, sit on $30 million? That'll look even worse.
Yeah, he has to spend some money, you know, and he'll do mail and he'll do the rest of it. And, you know, he'll win the primary and he'll win the general. But will he win the general with 70% of the vote? Because I think that's what they're hoping
for. That's what he wants.
So that he can have this mandate and go in and do whatever he wants to do, regardless of who controls the legislature. But what's interesting is the machinations that go on to keep people off the ballot. And we see it here in Albany County. You know, one candidate spent over $30,000 to defend her ballot position. For surrogate court here in Albany County. And you had just the other day the whole challenge to Peggy Walsh's slate for Supreme Court that got thrown out. And those
delegates will be able to go to the nominating convention.
Will be able to do what they want and vote how they want at the nominating convention. But it's the sense that, you know, these people who control the parties on the local level, state level, have the ability to control who's on the ballot, regardless of people doing what they're supposed to do to get on the ballot.
Well, what's the statistic about New York's election law? They say that if you have the election law books of all 50 states, New York's is thicker than the other 49.
Put together.
There are so many, nooks and crannies that politicians have put these little, rules into that they can pull out and knock you off a ballot for all these obscure reasons, like paper clips being on wrong.
And they're there to protect the incumbent. The election laws have been written to protect the incumbent. There's just no two ways about it. That's why the incumbent here usually wins.
Not just in the governor's mansion.
No, everywhere.
Everywhere.
Race. Everywhere. Yeah. In every race, from dog catcher all the way up.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll address an issue or two. We also welcome your letters, roundtable@wamc.org, and then we'll go to our NPR news break. Mike Spain, Ira Fussfeld, and Libby Post joining us this morning. We welcome your comments, roundtable@wamc.org. We'll be back after this short break.
Support comes from Dorset Theater Festival, Dorset, Vermont, presenting David Ives' comedy All in the Timing. DorsetTheaterFestival.org for tickets. Hudson Valley Foot Associates, podiatric physicians and surgeons treating foot problems with offices in Ulster, Dutchess, Columbia, Orange, and Delaware counties. HVFA.com. And William H. Buckley Farm, Ballston Lake, New York, offering natural, grass-fed, non-GMO beef, pork, poultry, and eggs. Cafe open Wednesday through Sunday, serving breakfast and lunch. BuckleyFarm.com.
Good morning and welcome back to...
And that monster is
Is I think that's you.
Oops. Sorry.
That's okay. That's all right. It's such a riveting program. Libby's watching something else.
No, really. It just happened. And I don't even know what it was. Because the NCAA video isn't playing on the time site.
We're in
sure.
such a...
Well, yeah. As somebody whose company sells these video ads... And I don't want to speak unkindly of them. I think Mike can relate to this also, is that often you will open up a page on website and one of the ads starts playing. Right. And that's great for the advertiser. It could be particularly embarrassing at a moment such as this, or if you're, if you're in the middle of a meeting and all of a sudden...
In the dentist office. Yeah. Right. The entire...
or church.
Yes, or church.
Or church, right. Well, this is all about our e-book subscriptions worth it, so that you and I can have that conversation offline.
Excellent. Okay. Sounds good.
Well, we're out of time.
we've just eaten up our time. Jim O'Donnell has an interesting story in the Times Union this morning regarding the Saratoga Racecourse, specifically the New York Racing Association, and about their CEO. And NYRA has done something they haven't done in a very, very long time.
You know, the New York Racing Association, governs the thoroughbred racing tracks in New York, and they've been running a big deficit. They've borrowed money they've needed to get bailed out by the state. The state has been increasingly trying to control and drive it, and they've been responsible for pushing out some leadership in the past. And their new CEO, Christopher Kay, who came from Toys R Us, he's an attorney and he's been in the theme park business.
That's really weird.
He has done something that those before him more recently have not been able to do, and that is put the Racing Association into the black. And when he was hired at the rate of $300,000 a year, they promised him a $250,000 bonus if he was able to do just that. And yesterday the board met and they awarded him that $250,000 bonus.
So are they still in the black? Now they've given them the money?
They continue to be in the black. It's interesting. They actually are in the black because they've been able to reduce the loss that they get every year by running the races. They get a lot of their revenue from the video lottery terminals at Aqueduct and from television rights and different things. But the races is actually a lost leader. And in the past, they'd lose $14 million. This year, they only lost about half of that. So that puts them well into the black, and they have rewarded Kay. You know, he says they're going to come out with a broader, longer range master plan, that will govern how they're going to have Aqueduct and Belmont and Saratoga. Of course, everybody here cares about Saratoga. He has had some criticism.
I just looked up and we're running out of time. We're going to think about how Mr. Kay can go to the track and make more money. We'll be back after this. Good morning and welcome back to our roundtable panel. Libby Post is here, Ira Fussfeld, Mike Spain, making up our panel this morning. We welcome your input, roundtable@wamc.org, roundtable@wamc.org. We were talking before the break about the New York Racing Association story and the CEO and President Christopher Kay getting a compensation bonus of $250,000 and a raise, we should note. And
a 3% raise.
A 3% raise.
3% of what?
$300,000.
Oh,
That's $9,000.
And he wrote
in. He got $250,000 bonus.
Yes.
So they pretty much just doubled his salary.
For this year.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And he wrote into the N to NYRA from riding his Toys R Us hobby horse,
right.
and becoming the shining knight.
Well, he's made a lot of changes and brought new people in, and they're doing things a lot differently, including the way that they have their meetings.
Yeah, running a public meeting and not letting the public in.
Right.
Without an appointment.
They invited the media, and those who didn't RSVP were left at the door, and that caused some stir yesterday during the meeting, but then halfway through they realized the error of their ways and let all the media in. As Bob Freeman, the executive director of the state's Committee on Open Government, said that, meetings are open to the public. You can't just invite people in and then keep some people
out. But think about that for a second, because somebody or one or more people of authority in planning this meeting had to have said to him or herself, here's the way it's going to run. And once the door is closed, we're not going to let anybody in, including media members.
Those who didn't reply to our invitation.
So in short, what were they thinking?
It shows some level of disconnect. I think it's new people in new places.
Yeah, they're coming from corporate America. You know, they don't have to let anybody in their meetings. You know, so.
And, but thankfully, the press being the press, you know, they all RSVP'd.
Oh, yes. Because we're always so polite and thoughtful, and we're always thinking ahead
before,
so much.
Yes,
all very good about returning.
Except one of them ordered the vegetarian plan.
held at the Saratoga National Golf Course. The meeting was yesterday. Let's move on to other issues, and we'll talk about the. I thought this was an interesting story about high-speed rail in the country, and if my voice holds out, I'll actually say it. Here we go.
High-speed rail in the country.
Was supposed to be President Obama's signature transportation project, but despite the administration spending nearly $11 billion since 2009, yes, I did say $11 billion, to develop faster passenger trains, the projects have gone mostly nowhere, and the U.S. still lags far behind Europe and China. While Republican opposition and community protests have slowed the projects here, transportation policy experts and members of both parties also place blame for the failures on missteps by the Obama administration, which in July asked Congress for nearly $10 billion more for high-speed initiatives.
Yeah, it was a great promise that we'd get these trains like in Europe and like in China. Some of them over there go for 220 miles an hour. I don't think anybody was talking about that here. But
150.
Yeah, but 150. I mean, what would that do to the commute from Albany to Manhattan? It would make it about an hour or a little more.
Well, does anybody in the room, I know some of the listeners will remember the name Stan Lundin.
Yes, oh, sure. Stan Lundin, the lieutenant governor.
Former lieutenant governor. And he
was Maglev.
Magnetic levitation, that was the technology that was going to bring trains at least from Albany to New York City and perhaps beyond, running right down the center of the thruway, as I recall.
Yes.
And it was widely met with disdain, and it just seemed to be, to the people who didn't like it, either a Buck Rogers kind of idea that would never happen. And you know, it takes foresight to design and implement big projects, and they're typically very expensive. But let's talk about what would have happened, say, during the Cuomo-Lundin administration, had that been moved forward. And now how many years later are we? 12 or so?
Still talking about
Could that not have now been come to fruition? And think of how great that would have been in an era of high gas prices and all and climate change and all of the rest. We should be encouraging this kind of development. And when you read a story such as this in the New York Times, which suggests that the Republicans, among others, don't see the viability of spending this kind of money to advance high-speed rail, you just want to do what they did in a Woody Allen movie, which was to slap your hand on your forehead and say, you know, give them one of these. And don't they get?
Well, think about it. Where are the biggest improvements needed, and where would most of this federal money go? To California? And the Northeast.
And California is having the same debate, by the way. They've wanted to run high speed from San Francisco to L.A. and have been fought every step of the way.
And people, you know, the politicians are behind it, but the localities, once they get involved, this and that, you know, you need a Robert Moses type who has the ability to push something through, and yet certainly many people were trampled by
I have many thoughts on it, because the, you know, the Accela, which was introduced in the Amtrak system, which goes, I believe, 80 miles an hour, and shaves, I don't know, 45 minutes off your trip, usually from New York to Washington or to Boston or from New York or wherever it is you're going. But the cost was so high that you know, okay, you can go the traditional way and you can spend 90, 110 bucks, whatever it is, depending on your rate and your time of day. And then meanwhile, the Accela was like 225, and you think, all right, well, yes, I want to save time, but now that there's the cost factor too, which I think really plays into this, it was a choice as opposed to this is the way it's going to be, and this is what's going to happen.
Well, that opens the debate about how much the government supports highways versus mm-hmm. how much they support rail passenger service. And, you know, the proponents of rail passenger service say it's way out of whack.
Yes.
And, you know, we're doing everything. Of course, we're having trouble funding highway improvements these days, too, because of Congress. But that's another story. But if you look at it, we are not dedicated to growing and improving rail service in this country the way they are in Europe and the way they are in China. And the results are here. We have kind of mixed results when it comes to it. The Northeast Corridor's pretty good, but it doesn't compare to what you get in Europe.
No, I mean, and that is, and I realize this is, I mean, I already said this earlier about an anecdotal, you know, example, but you go from London to Paris. It's a 2-hour trip, and they put you down. They treat you like a king and queen, and it's less money than it would be to go from Albany Rensselaer to Penn Station. It's pretty amazing. Of how
and that's
that all
through
goes.
The tunnel, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's a cool ride.
It's an absolutely very, very cool ride.
Through the tunnel, like underground through the tunnel.
Yeah, but you're not underwater for very long.
Oh,
that
okay.
was one of the things that surprised me. You're actually above ground most of the time. There's a quick little part there that's just like a
so
blip.
From London okay. to downtown, from London to downtown.
It's a
Paris.
Great ride, and yeah. and again, the point that was a key word that takes you to the downtown. Can consider all
right.
the amount of time that people save, business people save when they ride from Penn Station to Union Station in Washington. If the service was quick and if it was reliable, I saw a tweet again, anecdotal. One of the reporters for the New York Daily News tweeted last night. He apparently was waiting for somebody from Amtrak, who was taking from Boston to Albany, and the train was 90 minutes late, and he was bemoaning. And he said,
tough.
Who could be surprised? I take it that this is more often than not that train is not reliable. Why is that? This is not rocket science. Why can't we run the train?
When you think that Albany to Schenectady was the first passenger service in the world, really.
I mean, when they remodeled the Tappan Zee Bridge, an extraordinarily expensive project, a needed project because the bridge mm-hmm. is going to fall down, the current bridge, they saved money on the project by not instituting rail and bus,
lanes.
Bus.
Yeah.
Well, you know, somebody is going to regret that. It just seems like, yes, there's a lot of money, but you got to be thinking 50 years ahead if this bridge is going to last. What we just can't be thinking about tomorrow.
Well, you know, and we got into this, and not to go on a tangent on this, but I know we talked about this when there was the, I believe it was the Metro North derailing. And who owned the tracks? And we get into this a lot here of, well, who owns the tracks? Mm-hmm. And I know that's part of the problem when you get into these delays, that it's the operator of the train. Okay, that's all right. But then it's the owner of the tracks that ultimately is responsible, and that causes all kinds of problems. And then, you know, rock, paper, scissors, who's going to go through first? And it just becomes a whole mess.
Well, here's one that you might not initially think of as a roadblock to extending rail travel. The Metro North wanted to extend the New York City to Poughkeepsie line
yes.
on the existing tracks to move it up to Rhinecliff and maybe even Hudson.
Which I believe they still own, right?
Yeah, and the opposition from the Rhinecliff and Tivoli and Hudson area held sway, and the concern that they had was that train, as opposed to the more expensive Amtrak train, was more likely to bring quote-unquote undesirables farther up the river and bring with them crime and drug traffic. And
that's
so they
ridiculous, because Hudson was the waylay for drugs
sure.
in the 80s and the 90s,
sure.
and that was only Amtrak.
And you have people who are in the Rhinebeck area in Kingston and across east and west who would like to use Metro North, not only because it's less expensive, but because it runs more frequently mm-hmm. than does Amtrak, and if you want to take Metro North now, you have to drive down to Poughkeepsie.
Right.
So, yeah. But that was in opposition to it in a different sense to rail travel. And we're not even talking about high speed now. We're just talking about regular commuter rail.
Can't they just get a dog and put it on the train and let them sniff the bags?
No, it is. It's so difficult to make progress.
Put dogs to work.
Trying to get light rail in communities and commuter rail, and then, of course,
and you know, I would have a tendency to say it will take a tragedy of some sort to motivate the Congress to say, oh, we cannot let this tragedy happen again. And then you think about Newtown, for example, where everybody talked about Newtown and then nothing really happened as a result of it on an entirely different subject. So until they can figure out a way to get Washington working again, we're going to be sitting
here
talking
about it. Price of gas goes up to $7 a gallon, maybe.
But, the thing is that rail lost its luster when automobiles became more readily available and the individualization of transportation happened. And people wanted to be able to control their own destiny so they can get in their car and do that without regard to, what's the long-term impact of that? You know, global warming, all the carbon footprint.
But when the gas crisis and gas shortages occurred, a generation ago, that would have been the time for people to be motivated to produce rail traffic that we could now be utilizing.
Well, we just have to remember that, the Erie Canal was known as Clinton's folly, and look how good it was for the time we needed to use it and what it did in terms of commerce in the state.
Mm-hmm. Eric writes us and says there's a lot of focus on high-speed rail. I think it would be good to have between more regional city pairs, but the real news is passenger rail is how much it is growing in urban areas. Los Angeles had no rail 20 years ago. Now they have commuter rail, subways, and light rail. A number of cities are reintroducing streetcars. Many are putting in or expanding light rail systems. So.
They're currently extending the L.A. subway, light rail, whatever they call it, to the LAX area. I mean, imagine the boom that's going to mean to that kind of the usage and the favorable impact it's going to have on traffic on the 405.
And on smog.
The
reducing of smog.
George makes the point the major problem with Amtrak is the infrastructure is in terrible condition, especially the tracks, and people don't want to spend the money to fix it. The country is willing to give billions in subsidies to oil companies, but not willing to fund public
transport.
He's
right on the money.
Right.
I agree
with
him.
It's all about those kinds of interests in cars and oil and They want to make their profits.
The tragedy that happened on Metro North when the conductor failed to make that turn.
The choo-choo engineer.
That was pilot error apparently. But there's going to come a time on one of these major lines where the conditions of the tracks are going to create a similar tragedy. And will that be what motivates people to fix tracks? That probably about 10 days.
Yeah.
We also got this letter from Eric who says, you know what? I think I deleted the wrong letter. I'm sorry.
Oops.
Yep.
Right back, Eric.
Yeah, no, Eric's letter. That's the problem. I read Eric's letter and then I accidentally deleted the letter that I was going.
What is it about reading the mail?
This is real life.
I know, it is very hot. It's from Tom, actually, from Tom, who wanted to say that it's a big country, a lot of deserving projects for a lot of people. $11 billion is spitting in the wind, but it's what Obama could hope to get. So we welcome your letters, roundtable@wamc.org. I promise I won't delete your note. roundtable@wamc.org. We'll be back after the short break.
Support comes from the Springfield Museums, presenting their Summer Spectacular Family Series through August 15th with art and science activities daily, plus shows for children and adults Wednesdays through Fridays. SpringfieldMuseums.org. St. Mary's Healthcare, Amsterdam, New York, offering minimally invasive spine surgery. Choose stmarys.com. And the Schoharie River Center, presenting the Mohawk River Ecology Field School, ages 11 through 17, August 25th through August 29th. SchoharieRiverCenter.com.
All right, the panel just voted. We're going to talk about Nixon.
Oh, we're on the air. And you're
seven more minutes. Okay, seven more minutes.
Right, right. Yeah,
this just in.
What are we talking about? Right. Isn't it right? What was that?
Four more years. 7 more minutes.
Right.
Those of you who are going to be those panelists who are going to be with us tomorrow, those stories we didn't get to, we'll just we're going to put those on hold till tomorrow.
Because there's not going to be any other news.
No, that's right. Right. Well, it's summer.
It's
you know.
The dog days.
I know it
the
is.
Dog days. Absolutely.
Slow news days.
Tomorrow, earlier in the week on the program, we had John Dean and Pat Buchanan on, and there's a dream team. And then,
I asked you about that.
It were great. It was, the reason is tomorrow will mark the 40-year anniversary of President Nixon resigning the presidency, and it's unbelievable. So there's a couple things going on here. Number one is that there are new tapes available, which is funny in and of itself. His former aide Frank Gannon had these tapes, and he made these tapes in 1983. And then what is happening? This was part of Nixon's post-presidency attempt to rehabilitate his reputation. They are being released this week by the Nixon Presidential Library and Museum, and each day they are releasing a new set of tapes, which is fascinating. Also, there is a there's also a HBO documentary that I think aired on Monday night for the first time, and is playing this month on HBO, which is called Nixon in His Own Words. And I have to say, it is one of the most fascinating pieces of documentary film I have seen in a very long time. It is just Richard Nixon speaking. Now, you can certainly argue that it is taken out of context, that it is put together to put him into a bad light. But if you put into context the fact that these words were coming out of the President of the United States' mouth while he was in office, it is absolutely jaw-dropping. Did you see it, Ira?
Yeah, I saw most of it. It was, and the only reason I didn't see it all is I wasn't aware it was on, and I came into
yeah,
it in the middle.
That's exactly what happened.
Yeah. It's fascinating stuff. I one of the things that I think about, not just with Nixon and all that he became and all that he was, but I think about it even farther back in terms of FDR, to pick one person out, is what would their presidencies have been like, and how would they have been reelected, in Roosevelt's case, several times, in today's media environment, and in specifically today's cable news environment, mm-hmm. where their pictures were on the screen incessantly. Because I think that is one of the reasons why people who do not like this president, the current president, in part don't like him for philosophical political reasons, which is fine. But when you constantly see that person on screen, you want to throw a shoe at the mm-hmm. screen. And I remember when I was a kid, I was in college and just out of college during Nixon's time. I had a similar reaction, and he wasn't on TV nearly as much as you now are exposed to these people. So I don't know whether Nixon would have been even reelected in those days if there had been cable news.
Well, against George McGovern, he probably
could
have.
Be.
You know, it. But what I'm seeing a lot of are back and forth commentaries, and there's now this new narrative. Well, Nixon really was wronged, you know, by the press and by his political enemies. And, you know, things were pretty good back then, you know, and, you know, the economy was doing well and, you know, the cities were doing better. And then there's others who are, I think, appropriately pointing out the problems that Nixon had in his presidency, and it was an imperial presidency. And you know, it is kind of interesting to have that debate brought back, you know, and all the people from the Watergate era are coming back and making their, you know, they're all over the place, you know, making comments and things like that. But
were it not for Watergate, though, would history not treat Nixon well, do you think?
I think yes, other than Vietnam, because he opened up China, he opened up Russia. From a foreign policy point of view, and he did sort of get us out of Vietnam eventually. You know, it wasn't his, you know, 73, I think, was when it all was over. But, you know, he did do that foreign policy stuff rather well and opened up those doors. But the man was a megalomaniac, and, you know, wasn't, it was the imperial presidency. I remember when this happened. We were on vacation in Connecticut, in a little bungalow colony, and somebody had brought a TV with rabbit ears, and we put it on top of a car, and we all watched it, and we were fascinated, and we were all like jumping around for joy. But then that next Monday, I had to go in for knee surgery at the Hospital for Special Surgery in New York, and there was a young woman in my room, and it was like, he's a wonderful man. He should have never resigned.
Well, there's a lot of those who are saying,
I was amazed.
Trying to recast his image.
Although, I, to Joe's point, I would love to hear tapes from the Oval Office of every president.
Absolutely.
Because I wonder whether the same
language
does.
Well, I think they are there.
Yeah. Well, we're out of time, but we can talk. The anniversary is tomorrow. We'll talk more about it tomorrow.
Happy anniversary.
Thank you very much. We'll be back.